Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review for Thursday, December 6, 2018. We'll start with an article on the front page, headlined Election 2018, Root Announces Lawsuit, Republican Sheriff's Candidate Seeks Vote Recount, by Ryan Boyles, Decatur. Republican Jim Root announced Wednesday he'll file a lawsuit for a full recount of the Macon County Sheriff's race after his Democratic opponent, Sheriff Tony Brown, told him he would oppose a full hand count of all the ballots from the November 6th race. I asked Tony Brown to stand with me and take those steps to assure a full hand count of all legal ballots, to determine the actual winner of our race, and for each to accept the results, Root said in a news release Wednesday afternoon. However, Mr. Brown indicated he will oppose a full hand count. Regrettably, it appears that an adversarial lawsuit is imminent. When reached by phone Wednesday, Brown said he had not seen the news release and could not immediately comment. Wednesday's announcement is the most contentious step in what has been a long and complicated process since election night, when Root looked to be the winner with a 99-vote advantage over Brown. But on November 20th, when mail-in and provisional ballots were added to the vote total, Brown was declared the victor by a single vote, 19,655 to 19,654. As Brown was sworn in as sheriff on November 30th, Republicans, attorneys, and other local officials were in the Macon County Clerk's office as part of a discovery recount, a non-binding process that allowed Root and his team to review up to 25% of Macon County's 72 precincts, to determine if a petition for a full recount should be filed in Macon County Circuit Court. That process revealed the existence of two uncounted ballots, both for Root, in Hickory Point 1 precinct. With those ballots as evidence, the local Republican Party has asked new county clerk Josh Tanner, who took over for Bean on Monday, to nullify Brown's victory and to name Root the duly elected sheriff. Local and state officials have previously said it would be up to the court to change the results of the election, but the Republican request cited a part of the Illinois Election Code that covers how ballots are retabulated as evidence for why the results should be reversed without the need for a court order. Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott formally requested Tuesday that the Illinois Attorney General's office appoint a special prosecutor to advise on the situation. Two ballots were not the only issues raised by Root in his statement Wednesday. He said there is a ballot that went for Root in a ballot box in Hickory Point 7 precinct that was read by the machine as blank, as well as tabulating machines that on two separate occasions did not yield the same results on the same ballots. Root's letter did not indicate when a lawsuit may be filed seeking a full recount. Root has until 30 days after November 27th, the date county clerks must submit their election results to the Illinois State Board of Elections, to file the suit. Ultimately, with due respect to Tony and the citizens of Macon County, I cannot walk away from this matter when I know that but for the negligence of the election authorities, I would have been proclaimed the winner on November 20th, 2018, Root said in the release. Now, lawyers may decide whether and to what extent any recount follows. I do not believe that is what the public wants. More online. Read Jim Root's news release about his intention to seek a full recount, and watch a video of political reporter Ryan Boyles answering questions about the sheriff's race at herald-review.com. Crime. Cyber attacks hit school. Police. Mount Zion student tried to sabotage assignment, by Donette Beckett and Tony Reed. Mount Zion. Police say a student undertook a cyber attack on the Mount Zion School District computer network to sabotage a homework assignment, causing the system to crash. Mount Zion Police Lieutenant Mike Foster said the 18-year-old student launched the attacks using an app on his phone. Foster said the first was November 20th, when the district's computer system went down for about an hour. A second attack occurred on November 26th, and this time service was disrupted from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., he said. And a third and final attack disrupted the system again about 9:15 November 27th. Foster said by the following day, police had the information to trace the attacks, and the student was arrested. The student was able to penetrate the school system's computer network, but wasn't able to do any lasting damage, he said. The firewall was doing what it was supposed to do, and didn't let any information out or in, Foster said. He described the student cyber assault as involving a flood of information bombarding the school's computer system in what's typically called a distributed denial of service attack. With so much information being entered, it overloaded the system and shut down, Foster said. The student was given a notice to appear in court after police accused him of a preliminary charge of computer tampering. Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott said his office, which reviews all preliminary charges, had not yet received the paperwork on the case Wednesday morning. With computer tampering, some offenses are misdemeanors and some are felonies, he said. I don't know what this is yet until I read the information. Call seeking comment from Mount Zion School District Superintendent Travis Roundcount and Mount Zion High School Principal Cheryl Warner were not immediately returned Wednesday. Millikan University, Cookie Party Crumbles Test Stress, by Valerie Wells, Decatur. The week before finals is a stressful one for students everywhere, and Millikan University is no different as the fall semester draws to a close. That's why the annual Cookie Party is such a welcome respite, an opportunity to escape study sessions, however briefly, for a sweet treat and conversation not strictly tied to classwork. Held in the third-floor gathering area of the University Commons, the December event is so popular that the line snaked out of the room and all the way back to the stairs. This is literally the height of Millikan's traditions, said Genesis Brito, wearing a festive Christmas sweater complete with lights and a star atop her head, which she created herself. Everyone looks forward to it. It's at such an important part of the semester, when a lot of people are really down and are stressed out, and this is our one chance to take a break and enjoy something and just be happy for a little while. Classes end Friday, and finals are next week, which means that students have to buckle down and study. Indeed, even during the cookie party, there were students hunched over laptops and books scattered among the revelers in the University Commons building. On the ground floor, a group of students were laughingly turning Christmas songs into raps, and on the third floor, outside the actual cookie party, student musicians took turns performing while fellow students brought their plates of cookies and cups of cider, plopped cross-legged onto the floor, and listened. The cookie party began 85 years ago, said Molly Berry, director of the Office of Inclusion and Student Engagement, when the wives of faculty got together to bake cookies to help ease both staff and students' end-of-semester stress. Now, the staff donates cookies with a goal of 500 dozen, Barry said, and if they don't collect enough donations, they ask culinary students at Richland Community College to make cookies, too. Millikan President Patrick White, wearing his trademark Millikan ball cap with a Santa hat on top of it and a Christmas tie, greeted students with a handshake and a Merry Christmas. Staff members who were being kept busy refilling cookie trays from another room were also dressed in festive attire. Sitting on the floor in a corner, freshmen Julia Budd, Sam Lauro, Carly Klo, and Audrey Button, with junior Bailey Gwynn, enjoyed cookies and punch and conversation. Everyone in our classes told us, get there early and don't miss it, Budd said. It's a high-stress week, Laro added. Cookies and college kids really go well together. It's such a small school that it's a really good community, Klo said. We're able to have these events and really enjoy it. I don't think you'd get the same sense of community and fun at just any school, especially a big school. Teacher sentenced for sex abuse. Former Mount Zion woman to spend at least 2 years in prison. By Kara Berg, Lansing State Journal, Lansing. A former long-term substitute teacher and coach who sexually assaulted a student in Michigan will spend at least 2 years in prison. Allison Moran, 27, formerly of Mount Zion, abused her position as a teacher to take advantage of a 15-year-old boy Ingham County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Steve Kwasnik said. Even now, she still blames the boy and says he initiated the sexual acts, Kwasnik said. She used her position to gain his trust, and she took that and manipulated it into something for personal gratification, Kwasnik said. She lured him into an adulterous affair. Moran, who worked as a long-term substitute and as the girls' soccer coach at Stockbridge High School, about 90 miles west of Detroit during the 2016-17 academic year, was sentenced Wednesday to 25 months to 15 years in prison for third-degree criminal sexual conduct. Her attorney, Sean Carroll, said Moran was having a tough time. She'd just had a miscarriage. She and her husband were fighting, and she'd just gotten a new job at the district. It was a perfect storm of events, he said. She's faced alienation, stigma, and shame, Carroll said. She's grown from the situation. Carroll asked Ingham County Circuit Court Judge Joyce Draganchuk to sentence Moran to probation. He said losing her dream career and having to spend a lifetime on the sex offender registry was punishment enough. Moran apologized to the boy's parents and said she wished she could take their pain away. She said she slipped away after her miscarriage and made a lot of mistakes. I tried to find comfort wherever I could, Moran said. At 27, I will have a lifetime of consequences that will surpass any prison time. After Moran addressed her, Draganchuk reprimanded Moran for choosing a vulnerable victim. I wish so much that you had talked more about the lifetime of consequences he has, Draganchuk said. He's criticized and judged, and he didn't do anything wrong. The boy's mother said her son went from an involved, popular, happy child to someone who has lost himself. She took things from him he'll never get back, his mother said. Tell me how it's a child's fault that his teacher preyed upon him. The State Journal does not typically identify victims of sexual assault. When Moran was brought in for questioning by police, she texted the boy's best friend, saying he had ruined her life, that she was going to die. Why did he tell? According to court records. After Moran was charged, she attempted suicide. The boy carries the guilt of that with him and feels it is his fault, his mother said. Her son is ridiculed and judged at school, and plans to graduate early because he dreads going to school. He's missing out on his teenage years because of what she did, she said. Moran was taken into custody in Decatur, where she was living at the time, a week after the charges were filed and extradited to Michigan. Mom-child interviews to be heard. Recordings allowed as evidence in criminal sex abuse trial. By Tony Reed. Decatur. A series of recorded interviews with a young Decatur girl about her repeated rapes and her mother's harrowing testimony about learning of the assaults from her child will be allowed as evidence in the trial of the 34-year-old man accused of the crimes. Judge Thomas Griffith ruled they would be admitted to the case at a motion hearing in Macon County Circuit Court on Tuesday. Antoine J. Ward has pleaded not guilty to two counts of the predatory criminal sexual assault of a child under 13. Through his defense attorney, Tiffany Senger, Ward had objected to the recorded interviews made during investigations into the alleged assaults as being riddled with inconsistencies. Senger also said the hearsay evidence of the mother, who had coaxed her daughter to speak after telling the child of the sexual abuse she too had suffered as a girl, was not reliable. But Griffith, who listened to the tearful mother give her testimony in the hearing after also listening to the taped interviews, accepted the opposing arguments of Assistant State's Attorney Kate Kurtz. In the case of the evidence of what she said to her mother, Kurtz said the girl doesn't just parrot back what's said to her, but tells her own singular story of abuse. Kurtz acknowledged there were inconsistencies in the taped interviews about time and places, but pointed out the child had moved around a lot and lived a life that is chaotic and unstable. Kurtz added, but when she is describing the different things that happened to her, she is consistent. A sworn affidavit about the case from Decatur Police Officer Martin St. Pierre said the girl had said Ward started raping her when she was in first grade and had repeatedly assaulted her over a span of years. St. Pierre said forensic evidence from the girl's underwear had linked Ward to the assaults. Judge Griffith set a pretrial hearing for January 4th. He said inconsistencies and problems with evidence will be best dealt with during the trial by cross-examination of witnesses. Stepson Accused of Stealing Guns by Tony Reed, Harristown. A man stole firearms and ammunition valued at more than $1,600 from his stepfather's home near Harristown and said he exchanged them on the street for $70 worth of methamphetamine, according to Macon County Sheriff's deputies. The 31-year-old man was arrested Monday by deputies and booked on a preliminary charge of theft over $500, which is subject to review by the state attorney's office. A sworn affidavit by Deputy Drake Lambden said the 57-year-old stepfather noticed the weapons, 3 handguns and 6 loaded magazines, were missing Monday afternoon. Lambden said the stepfather suspected the stepson had taken the guns because he had access to the room where they were kept and could take them without setting off an alarm. Lambden said deputies didn't have to go far to find the stepson, who was already being held in the Macon County Jail on other charges. Barely 2 hours after the gun theft was reported, at 1:40 p.m., Lambden said the stepson had been questioned, had confessed, and was rearrested on the theft charge by 3:45 p.m. He advised that he was using meth and pills heavily and did take all 3 guns from his stepfather, Lambden said. He stated that he sold the guns on the street. The man remained in the Macon County Jail on Wednesday night in lieu of posting $30,000 bond on the new charge. If he makes bail and is released, he's ordered to stay away from his stepfather and his stepfather's home. Demirjian Huss requests place on ballot. Former mayoral candidate critical of how paperwork handled by Tom Lissy, Decatur. Kara Demirjian Huss sent a letter to city officials on Tuesday requesting her name to be put on the ballot for mayor and criticizing their handling of the filing process after she failed to submit all the required paperwork. I'm disappointed that during the week-long submission period, I received no notice from the city suggesting my materials were incomplete, Demirjian said in the letter. Although any action or inaction by the city may not be a violation of law, when foregoing observations are reviewed in their totality, I believe that my supporters, campaign staff, and I are compelled to deliver this request to the city. The request comes from the marketing executive a week after the city clerk, Kim Althoff, notified Demirjian Huss's nominating petitions for office could not be certified because she had not included a receipt showing she had filed what's called an economic statement of interest, a legal form that lists any business or financial interest the candidate may have with the local unit of government for which they're running for office. Demirjian Huss said in the letter that she learned the city clerk went through a checklist of the required forms needed for a complete petition with other candidates, and I believe I did not receive the same assistance. On Wednesday, Althoff said she did indeed tell Demirjian Huss that the receipt for the form was needed, and provided a copy of the checklist to the Herald and Review that Demirjian Huss signed on November 19th when she filed her paperwork. The line for the missing receipt of economic interest is unchecked, with a note from Althoff reading, "Brought in statement of economic interest, 8 a.m. Need receipt." I took each candidate into my office to accept their nominating papers, Althoff said. While going through the checklist with Ms. Demirjian Huss, Althoff said she immediately noticed that she had the statement of economic interest attached within her nominating papers rather than the receipt. At that moment, I informed her that the form needed to be filed with the Macon County Clerk's Office, which is clearly stated at the top of the form, and that I needed the receipt, which was also noted on the checklist. At that time, I had her remove the statement of economic interest from her nominating papers and told her that I needed the receipt. Demirjian Huss disputes that account. She took my petition paperwork and told me that I needed to file a statement of economic interest at the county, and they'd give me a receipt. That is all she said to me, Demirjian Huss said. Demirjian Huss also said in the letter she requested a meeting with Althoff to answer questions she had about properly filling out the documents required to run for office. But you refused to meet with my representative, citing your inexperience with elections. Althoff also refuted that claim on Wednesday. Neither Ms. Demirjian Huss or anyone representing themselves as being from Ms. Demirjian Huss's campaign ever contacted us to request a meeting, she said. The only call that we received about a potential meeting was from a local attorney asking to meet to discuss past issues. My response was that this was my first election and that I hadn't experienced any issues, and the attorney said, okay, we never refused any meeting with anyone. No candidates were treated differently than Demirjian Huss, Althoff said. It was me who noticed that Ms. Demirjian Huss's filing was not complete. No candidate or candidate supporter brought it to my attention. Also, no other candidate failed to file the receipt. While there is no law that bars election administrators from giving advice or direction to candidates on the filing process, Illinois State Board of Elections spokesman Matt Dietrich said it's a general practice that they not do so. The main reason is concern for appearing to favor a candidate, or be held liable for giving the wrong advice, or being misinterpreted, he said. If a case comes to a court challenge and ends up in court, that could create problems for the clerk, Dietrich said. The clerk could be accused of giving a certain candidate more help than another candidate. Or it could be the clerk's guidance is misinterpreted by the candidate, who then may blame the clerk for any problems that may arise from the candidacy later. Dietrich said such issues are in part why state election officials produce a candidate's guide for each election, meant to spell out the requirements and timelines for each of the elections administered in Illinois, including a receipt of the Statement of Economic Interest. In State Board of Elections 2019 Candidate's Guide, it also provides a warning to residents wishing to run for office. Candidates are strongly advised to obtain legal counsel regarding their qualifications for office, the proper method for completing the petition forms for a specific office, the minimum and maximum number of signatures required, the qualifications of the signers and circulators, etc. Demirjian Huss said she did consult with attorneys before filling out her paperwork with the city, but she did not know if they had experience in election law. Barring any changes in the mayor's race, incumbent Mayor Julie Moore Wolf will appear first on the ballot in the April 2nd election, followed by Councilman David Horn and Jacob Jenkins, an employee at the Illinois Department of Human Services. Accountant Siobhan Francis will appear first in the ballot for City Council, followed by retiree Marty Watkins, Taylorville Correctional Center Warden Sheila Hansbrough, incumbents Lisa Gregory and Bill Faber, followed by auto garage owner John Phillips Jr., and Rodney Walker, CEO of Skywalker International Sports Complex. Councilwoman Dr. Dana Ray opted to step down at the end of her term. Central Illinois Man Among Pallbearers by Kevin Barlow, Monticello. Among President George H.W. Bush's pallbearers Wednesday was Captain Chris Blanchard, a Central Illinois native who serves with the Old Guard, a historic Army unit that serves as the President's ceremonial escort. It's definitely a huge honor to be able to pay your respect in this way, said Blanchard, who could be seen standing at the head of the casket, which also was flanked by six pallbearers from the various armed services. The former DeLand Weldon High School student enlisted in the Illinois National Guard after graduating from Monticello High School in 2005. He attended Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville and was commissioned from there into the Army in 2009. He serves in the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment. Founded in 1784, it is the oldest active-duty infantry unit in the Army. In addition to providing security for Washington, D.C., the unit serves as the honor guard for such events as White House ceremonies and state funerals. Members guard the Tomb of the Unknowns and provide funeral escorts at Arlington National Cemetery. I was a company commander out of Fort Lewis, Washington, and I applied to come out to what they call the Old Guard in Washington, D.C., he said. He previously was a pallbearer for Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, who died August 25th. We were informed Saturday morning about the passing of President Bush, and so we began preparations immediately, he said. While the company practices their routines all year long, they review and practice several more times to ensure they are professional and no mistakes are made. The funeral and procession was witnessed by thousands and viewed by millions on television. Blanchard said his role at funerals has given him occasions to reflect on his own life and the people in it. You think about your grandparents and your parents for sure, he said. They were such huge role models for me. And you just think about all of the lessons you've learned from them and how they played a part in getting you to this point. I've taken lessons from all of them, as well as other family members, he said. You take those lessons and then work hard. Married, with two twin girls at home, Blanchard said he's trying to save as many pictures of the funeral as he can. He's anxious to tell his stories to his daughters. After the funeral was over, Blanchard admitted to being exhausted. It's mentally exhausting and kind of how you feel in the fourth quarter of a football game, he said. But the amount of pride and support you received from friends and family, and of course your friends in the Army, is amazing. You just want to do the best you can. Blanchard didn't get the chance to meet the president's family. They stand right behind you, and it is an amazing feeling to be that close, he said. But we have a job to do. We have to be professional and keep our minds on what we're doing. News Roundup. Chicago. Police probe alleged attack on teenager. Chicago's police oversight agency is investigating an officer who apparently struck a teenager repeatedly with a pair of handcuffs while arresting him. Ephraim Adey is a spokesman for the Civilian Office of Police Accountability. He says the police is investigating the officer's apparent use of force. The Chicago Sun-Times reports officers were trying to detain a 16-year-old boy at a South Loop train station on November 25th, who matched the description of a robbery suspect, when he threatened them, clenched his fists, and began flailing his arms. Cell phone video shows an officer apparently strike the teen over the head 5 times with a closed fist and handcuffs during the arrest. Police said the boy was released without being charged because officers failed to get statements from the alleged robbery victim. Jury awards $21.5 million in boys drowning. A Cook County jury has awarded $21.5 million to the family of a 6-year-old boy who drowned during a summer camp in suburban Chicago. The family of Michael Duda claimed he wasn't properly supervised while part of a Justice Park District summer camp outing to a park pool in the neighboring community of Bridgeview in June 2014. He was pulled unresponsive from the water, and his death was ruled an accident. Family attorney Bradley Cosgrove said Michael didn't know how to swim and should have been in the wading pool rather than the deeper main pool. He says video showed camp counselors for Michael's group were inside the pool's locker room and not outside watching the children. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Herald and Review for Thursday, December 6th, 2018. Please stay tuned.